You're listening to a podcast from the World Stroke Academy, the educational platform of the World Stroke Organization.
On the occasion of International Women's Day, we at the World Stroke Academy want to celebrate the achievements and careers of women in stroke and highlight female leadership. We interviewed outstanding women who were nominated by WSO board members for their important contributions to the field of stroke.
This is the 13th episode of the Women in Stroke Initiative podcast. My name is Alina Schwarz and I'm the Executive Manager of the World Stroke Academy. Today I'm here with Professor Joanna Wardlow. Hi Joanna. Joanna Wardlow is Professor of Applied Neuroimaging at the University of Edinburgh and Consultant Neuroradiologist NHS Lothian. She has worked for many years to understand the brain and its blood supply and on treatments to improve blood flow to the brain, including thrombolytic drugs that are now used routinely. She now focuses on the much more complicated problem of small vessel disease. A fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh and of the UK's Academy of Medical Sciences, she was the first woman to be awarded the American Heart Association's Feinberg Award for Clinical Advances in Stroke, and one of the very few non-USA awardees ever. She was one of 35 women in medicine recognized by the UK Royal Medical Colleges and was made a Commander of the Order of the British Empire for services to medicine and neuroscience in 2016. Other recent recognition includes the European Stroke Organization President's Award and the Karolinska Stroke Award. Welcome, Joanna. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So as we've heard, you've had a very impressive career in stroke medicine. Could you take us back in time and tell our listeners how you did become interested in stroke medicine?
Well, when I was a trainee doctor, probably about halfway through my postgraduate training, I was training to do neuroradiology, and I happened to read a case report about a patient with basilar thrombosis who had been treated with thrombolysis intraarterially. And it got me thinking because I had been involved in early trials in thrombolysis for myocardial infarction, and I was very aware that there had been a lot of controversy about those trials. And at this time, which was in the early 1990s, recent stroke was the number one contraindication to use thrombolysis for myocardial infarction. But it got me thinking, and there seemed to be no sense in, if you have a blocked blood vessel in your brain, it doesn't make any sense to leave it blocked if you could possibly reopen it. And so I did a clinical fellow where I ran a small trial of intra-arterial thrombolysis starting in 1990, which in those days was quite adventurous. And gradually that changed into trials of intravenous thrombolysis. And then, as you know the history, larger and larger trials, and then eventually IST3, and then putting all of the data together, which clearly show that thrombolysis is beneficial. So that's what got me originally interested. It was challenging the ideas that I was surrounded by that were medical dogma, but as it turns out, were just completely wrong, and has opened up a whole new field of ways that we can treat stroke. Stroke's now one of the most treatable brain diseases that there are, and it's fantastic.
What's your career advice for young women about to take the first steps in stroke research?
I would really encourage anybody who's interested in questions about stroke to take every opportunity that they can to pursue those questions, whether these are in clinical research or preclinical research. There's so many unanswered questions. I would really encourage young women to do this. It's a fascinating area. It's extremely rewarding. As people will know, there have been huge advances purely because of adventurous research. And I think we hear a lot about men and women, but I just think it's so important that women participate and use their skills to advance the field. I always find it astounding that there are these divisions, but they're very real. And all I can say is, please do not be put off. Do not let people deflect you from your interests and your ideas. It's really important that, you know, women pursue stroke research.
That leads me to a follow-up question. So where do you see opportunities for women in the field? Could you be more specific?
Everywhere. I don't think there is any particular aspect of stroke clinical care or stroke research that would not benefit from greater involvement of women. Women are thoughtful, they are careful, they are often, they've often thought about something very hard before they put it forward. And so perhaps there's more chance that that thought will be more correct or more ready to test. And we need that. You know, the last thing we need in research is recklessness or hastiness. We need, you know, caution and thoroughness and careful consideration and, you know, leave no stone unturned. And no idea is too small to be worth thinking about or too extreme. You know, some of the most major advances in medicine have come from what initially looked like quite extreme ideas. So I just think that women have an enormous role to play, and the more women that pursue a research career, the better. I think we will all benefit.
So what do you think are reasons for women's lack of advancement into leadership positions, despite there being no visible barriers? Could you allude on that?
I mean, this is a difficult area. Obviously, I've lived through an era myself where actually some things have changed, but on balance, not very much has changed. And I came from a background where things were very equal. Women did the same jobs as men and at the same levels, and it never occurred to me that that wasn't the same, you know, the case everywhere. I moved when I was in my early teens to another country where things were very different, I think it took me a long time to realize that there is a glass ceiling and there are reasons why some people move up the ladder faster than others, and it's nothing to do with ability. People are advanced for many reasons, and frequently it's nothing whatsoever to do with ability. So I guess what I would say is it's really important that women at all levels encourage other women to look for opportunities for advancement, to put themselves forward. I think sometimes women are a bit hesitant about putting themselves forward. You know, we're often very conscious of our family duties, or you know, we're quite thoughtful about, you know, can I take this extra job on? Will it simply overload me? Am I being unrealistic? And maybe that stops people going for something, when in fact, if they did go for it, it might open up another door. It might actually be more manageable than you know, perhaps the person was thinking about to start with. So I would strongly encourage people to go for things and not hold back. I would also encourage women in more senior positions to try and bring forward younger women. I think we have to recognize that there are a lot of unconscious things that go on in selection committees and, you know, in all sorts of walks of life. And try and overcome those and not be put off. I think it's really hard to come up with any very specific advice apart from it's really important to be aware that there are these barriers. It's really important to be aware that if you don't put yourself forward, it, you know, somebody may not put you forward. So you've got to try and take opportunities when you see them. Don't be put off by feeling that, you know, people might think you're pushy or, you know, there's all sorts of different, as I said, subconscious, unconscious things. I think, you know, there are ways of saying, I would like to do this. I think I have the qualifications to do this. I have done, you know, X, Y, and Z previously, and I did them very well. So I think I can bring great skills to this particular role. You know, there are ways of emphasizing the positives about, you know, an individual that often, you know, I think the world is a poorer place for currently having fewer women in leadership positions. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to try and fix that balance.
Definitely. So the next question I would like to ask you is, what does it mean for you when somebody is outstanding in your area of research or field of stroke? And do you agree with current criteria?
I think for me, somebody who is outstanding is somebody who has really made a huge impact in terms of knowledge, changing the way we do things on a day-to-day basis, who has taken an idea and followed it through because they thought it was an important question, not because it was a popular question or it happened to be a fashionable question at the time, or because that's what everybody else was researching, so I must research that too, blah, blah, blah. I think it's where, you know, somebody has really stuck to their guns. They have really researched the question very thoroughly so that, one, you know, we, the public, you know, can be very confident that that answer is right, that it won't be overturned in a few years because of some awful, you know, erroneous results or something that was covered up, or, you know, any of these things which we're very surrounded by in science now. So I think it's got to be, you know, somebody who's very credible, somebody who's very reliable, somebody who is trustworthy, you know, somebody whose work has stood the test of time. It's not just somebody who runs a big department and is commonly seen on the platform at conferences giving talks. There's got to be a bit more to it than that. You know, I think in terms of, you know, research and knowledge and moving the field forward, we're on a conveyor belt. You never get to the final point. You might answer one bit of a question, but there's always another pile of questions behind that one. So it doesn't ever stop. And just because you're expert in one thing 1 week doesn't mean that you're going to be the expert the following week, because somebody else might come along with some new piece of information which completely changes thinking. So I think I have a slight wariness of inverted commas experts, because it's often the case that people who are seen as experts in certain areas, there's a danger that they become very protective of their expert idea and almost counterproductive, because then they try and block, you know, subconsciously or whatever, you know, papers coming through which might suggest alternative explanations for a particular finding. So I think it's not just somebody who is seen to be an expert in an area, because they may be completely wrong. It's somebody who's really pursued something in depth and demonstrated beyond absolute reasonable doubt, without a question, that this is the right answer. And here are the unanswered questions, because there are always unanswered questions. And an honest person, you know, who really understands their subject will also highlight, this is what we don't know, guys. You younger people need to go out and find the answers.
That's a really powerful and great message. What has been the greatest achievement of your career?
Well, I was a single parent for many years, and just getting to work on time was quite a major achievement. I think actually it's, you know, every day I walk into the hospital where I work, and it's amazing to see something like, you know, thrombolysis for a stroke is an absolutely routine treatment. And it is now implemented around the world. And alteplase is on the WHO list of essential drugs. And to think that barely, just under 30 years ago, like I said at the beginning, thrombolysis was, or stroke rather, was the number one contraindication to giving thrombolysis for heart attacks. So to see something go from being a, gosh, this is a bit of a wacky idea. And obviously many other people have also pursued this. A huge number of very eminent individuals have made huge contributions to this field. Otherwise, you know, it would never have happened. Massive trials and huge efforts and overcoming considerable controversy. But just to be able to walk in and see that people are actually benefiting from this, and instead of having what would have been an absolutely wipeout stroke that completely devastated their life, and you know, left them dependent or dead or unable to return to work, etc., etc. You know, and it's not perfect, but in general, thrombolytic treatment has huge benefits and means that people are walking out of hospital. Overall, the benefits are massive. I think is one of the things that I'm probably most proud of. I would like to see something similar come about for small vessel disease, because I think that's the big neglected area of our time. And we're about 20 years into small vessel disease, so maybe in another 10 years there'll be something similar.
I mentioned in your resume that you're now focusing more on small vessel disease, and that leads me to my final question. Could you tell us something about your ongoing research projects and any future plans?
Yeah, so the kind of obsession at the moment is small vessel disease. It's an area that is very neglected. It's seen as being something which is silent and just happens as you get older. Well, guess what? As it turns out, it's not silent, and it's a major adverse impact on health in terms of future stroke and dementia risk. It does actually cause symptoms, it's just they're not traditional neurological or stroke symptoms, so they kind of get ignored. It's very debilitating. We make all sorts of assumptions about the causes, because you know, if you work in the field of stroke and you see a white spot on an MR scan, you assume it's ischemic, because we're so used to large artery occlusion, ischemic strokes, etc., etc. Actually, that's probably not the case. We're beginning to get quite a lot of insights into the true vascular dysfunction, and testing drugs and interventions which may help slow down the progression. We recently found with other groups that the lesions that you see on scans, they can actually get better, which means that this is not a permanent, you know, inexorably progressive condition. It is remediable. I think particularly in the last 5 to 8 years, there's been a lot of progress, big genetic studies, big epidemiology studies, and now trials which are really beginning to give us lots of answers about mechanisms as well. And we're beginning to get to the point where we can write clinical guidelines about, even if we don't know a lot about what you should do, we are beginning to know quite a lot about what you shouldn't do. And some things about what you should do. And while, you know, hypertension is a major risk factor and it's really important that hypertension is properly managed, it's not going to solve the problem. You know, there's increasing numbers of trials which have tested intensive antihypertensives, and they may slow progression of white matter, small vessel disease, but only by a very tiny amount. And it just means that there's a lot of something else going on that we haven't really addressed, and we need to tackle that also. And there's some things that we definitely shouldn't be doing, which I think perhaps are quite commonly done. So we're getting to a place where there's enough mechanistic understanding to get a bit of an insight into how we might help people on a day-to-day basis. But I really hope that with trials and more mechanistic studies that are now happening, that within another few years we'll be in a much better position and actually have, you know, positive drugs or interventions which we can recommend, which we know will definitely have benefit.
This sounds very exciting, and I'm sure it will inspire many, many more young male and female stroke researchers. Thank you, Joanna, for participating in this interview and for sharing these insights with us. It was wonderful to have you.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.